we take the carbon atoms in this lump of coal, they're not worth very much because they're random and unstructured. But if we were to take those same atoms and rearrange them into a crystal, they're diamond. I started Zybex in 97. I had a successful software company before that. I sold that for a lot of money, and that has allowed me to invest more money in nano than any human on the planet. So I'm either the greatest fool that you've ever seen, or I have a vision that maybe I haven't yet achieved that says this is worth spending my life's fortune on and my life's time. So we've built a number of products along the way. I've been involved since even before I started Zybex, endowed the Feynman Prize in Nanotechnology. That is a prize which will go to the embodiment of a particular nanotech device. Along the way, we're giving yearly awards, which have turned out to be very prestigious awards. It's not a lot of money, $5,000, but professors now list that as one of the top things that they have won. So it's gratifying that this relatively small award has turned into such a prestigious thing. I realized when I started Zybex that we were having trouble recruiting people to Texas, so I also started the Texas Nanotechnology Initiative to focus on bringing people together to Texas. That led to University of Texas at Dallas starting up the Nanotech Institute. And after I endowed a bunch of money to start that, they came back and said we'd like to have a chair, endowed a chair for our first recipient of that chair turned out to be the Nobel Prize winner, Alan McDermott, who had discovered conducting plastic. And so it was great to get to know him. So anyway, I've been involved in nano for quite a while. So what do I mean by nanotechnology? Well, molecular nanotechnology I define as a precise controlled rearrangement of atoms into a higher value form. So if we take the carbon atoms in this lump of coal, they're not worth very much because they're random and unstructured. But if we were to take those same atoms and rearrange them into a crystal, they're diamond, same carbon atoms, just a different structure. Suddenly they're worth a lot more money. Now, of course, if we were to take those and arrange them into a different form, leaving out most of those atoms and putting them just where we wanted, we might have some super strong materials, we might have some incredible computers, and I think the breakthrough that most people are going to care about, we could have some amazing medical devices, devices that actually would go into your body, tumble around in your bloodstream, get carried to a spot where they might find the right chemical environment, start working, and cure cancer. Some people believe that old age is a curable disease. If it's going to be cured, it's going to be cured by nanotechnology devices that can go work at the scale of the molecules in your cell. Nature is a nanotechnology using endeavor. And some of my favorite examples are up here. On the right, we have the abalone shell, a micro picture of that. These are little nanostructured plates of calcium carbonate, which is chalk, layered together with a biopolymer, which I think of as snot. So we are structuring chalk and snot, and by the nanostructuring in just the right arrangement, this material is 3,000 times tougher than either material alone. And as an engineer, I think if I had today's strong engineering materials, which are better than snot and chalk, and I had the right structuring, what could we do with materials to make some incredible things that we can't make today because we don't have control of the nanostructures? And most of you are familiar with butterfly wings, the iridescence of those. This morpho wing is interesting. They've just puzzled out the structure, actually, probably in the last 10 years or so. Some of these nanostructures, the pictures, the micro pictures from electron microscope that you see here, you can't quite appreciate the detail, but they've analyzed how these interact with the light that lands on this wing to produce this very bright blue. It's a combination of the nanostructures of the wing, some dyes underneath these nanostructures that absorb all the light that isn't blue, but it produces a very striking blue by having structures smaller than the wavelength of light that play with the light. So I think if we can apply nano, we're going to see a lot of applications in advanced materials, clean, cheap energy, maybe something a little bit more efficient than today's solar cells, applied a little bit better. Plants are great at harnessing energy. They're not very efficient. We could do better with the right kind of nanostructures. And computers, we calculated at one point that if we built a computer the size of a sugar cube with nanostructured materials, it would have more compute power than all the computers ever built in the world. So how do we do this? Well, nature's been doing it since the first life. One of my favorite nanotech devices that I sometimes bring along to a conference with me is this acorn. Inside this acorn, there's an energy supply and nut. The DNA, the molecular material, is a computer program that says what to do. And this is full of little molecular machines, proteins, and aggregations of proteins that actually are molecular motors that transport things around inside this cell, that rearrange the molecules of dirt, water, and air, which is really all it has to work with. It's a solar-powered factory. And by rearranging those atoms, we're able to build an oak tree, which is really an acorn manufacturing plant. It's a pretty nice factory. Most of us would not mind having this factory in our backyard. It's solar powered, produces excess energy. It used to be what mankind built the world out of is the wood. And wood is a fascinating material. It's a nanostructured composite, similarly to the abalone, because of the right kinds of nanostructures applied in the right way. It's strong, light, grows for free. We can cut it down, turn it into furniture. It's a good start on where we're going to go with nano in the future. But we're an engineering company. I'm an engineer. How do we do this? We're not going to work with nature's efficiency. We don't have billions of years to evolve what we're trying to do. So I boiled this down when I started Zyvex to really two things: positional chemistry. How do we perform a chemical reaction at a particular spot? So manipulate the environment so that these molecules react the way we want. Once we can do that, then how do we do the system design to build a factory to let us do this in parallel? Because if we have a machine that will do one chemical reaction at us, let's say we can do it really fast, a million a second, it's going to take billions of years for us to build something big enough to see if we're doing billions of reactions a second. So we need a huge parallel system. And in fact, in our bodies, in the tree, in every living thing, we have millions or billions or trillions of cells, all of which have a lot of molecular motors and molecular machines inside doing the work in parallel. And that's really what's key to making nanotech practical. So we have a couple of ways to look at it: the wet side, which is the bio, and the dry side, which is today's nano. Most people stop it here. Professors stop dividing it in these two columns. I like to separate into two rows also and say we got passive, things that just work because of their shape or their charge. All of biotech is down in here, all of drugs. It's a pretty lucrative endeavor just with this one quadrant. But nature actually works up here, that inside our cells, inside living machines, they're active nano. We have molecular motors that are right now taking our lunch, disassembling it into the chemical constituents, reassembling it into things like fat. And so I'm turning lunch into me, thanks to all these molecular machines that are actively transporting stuff around. And our cells are just chock full of these molecular machines. So they manufacture by using machines at a similar scale to the products that they make, which is what we do in a machine shop. But most of nano today is down in this area. We're taking huge machines, trying to manipulate precise small things. It doesn't work very well. What we need is to get a clue from nature and build machines that are of a size similar to the products they make. Build those machines out of the products that they make so we can bootstrap up. And that's what Zyvex is trying to do. So here's a close-up view of the nano probing system. And what we have here is up to 8 probes that can land on an integrated circuit. These things are very sharply etched tungsten wires. We can actually land one of them on a 1 micron square. And to give you a size of the nanoscale, let me just go down the size scale. We'll start with a millimeter. We go a tenth of a millimeter, 100 microns. That's about the diameter of one of my coarse beard hairs, 100 microns, 100 micrometers. A tenth of that, 10 microns, is about the size of one of our cells, a diameter of a cell. A tenth of that, 1 micron, is about the size of a bacteria. A tenth of that, 100 nanometers, is about the size of a virus. A tenth of that, 10 nanometers, is about the size of a large protein cluster, a molecular machine. A tenth of that, 1 nanometer, is about the size of a large molecule, or the diameter of a nanotube. And a tenth of that, 1 angstrom, is about the size of an atom. So we go down. The nano field that's interesting is in the range of 100 nanometers, size of a virus, down to about 1 nanometer, the size of a large molecule. So we're probing now with this system semiconductor parts that are down to about the 20 nanometer size. That's about how big the features of a transistor are these days. So this works in an electron microscope. This is the high-end system of Zyvex. We buy a commercial electron microscope, rip off the front door, replace it with our own nano probing stuff. This whole rack is developed by my company, the software that goes on it. Our first one was for university work, sold for about $100,000. This sells for over $2 million in the high-end configuration. Semiconductor industry can use this, probe one chip, learn some design changes to improve their yields, and save tens of millions of dollars a year per chip. My other company, Zyvex Performance Materials, had a breakthrough in processing carbon nanotubes, and we were able to functionalize and solubilize and process these things in a way no one else has been able to do before or even after, which has allowed us to have a lot of advanced materials. We got interest from some of our partner companies. Arkema, French multinational chemical company, invested in here a few years ago. They make our nanotubes. Lockheed Martin made an investment. Both of those own about 10% of the company. We have our headquarters in Columbus, Ohio, but we also have an office in Richardson, Rapid City, South Dakota, and our newest one, Zyvex Marine, up in Seattle. So with that, we use carbon nanotubes. About 15 years ago, I guess, they were discovered. Little rolled-up tubes of carbon. They're about a nanometer to a few nanometers in diameter. Imagine chicken wire, a hexagonal chicken wire, rolled up into a tube. If you take the chicken wire, it's kind of floppy in the plane. But if you roll it up into a tube, it becomes pretty stiff. And that's what makes nanotubes great. In the plane, a nanotube is just graphite, which is carbon in a different arrangement. I talked about the diamond, which is carbon in a 3D arrangement. Graphite is carbon in a 2D sheet. And it turns out it's the strongest known material. It is the best known electrical conductor. And it is the best known heat conductor. It's a pretty amazing material. When you roll it up into a tube, it also becomes a very strong construction material. It's about 100 times stronger than conventional steel in tensile strength. Now, we're not getting all of that property yet, but we're able to tap into a little of it. So with that, we can make materials that are about 40% better than the industry's best carbon fiber today. And making this advanced carbon fiber allows us to make products like this bicycle. We are working on some aerospace applications, and where I'm really going commercial here is in this boat. There's a picture of our boat up in Seattle. The guy that designed it, president of the company that makes it, Zyvex Performance Materials, and I think I was in the chase boat here during our sea trials. Our material is called Aerovex. It's about, as I said, about a 40% improvement in mechanical properties. Huge weight decrease in the boat. We're able to use less material, which makes the boat lighter, which means we can use smaller engines, which means we can go faster for a given amount of fuel. And the fuel usage in this boat, this is kind of a stripped down model, but the fuel usage is pretty amazing. So in Singapore, we're commercializing this new boat called Vigilant as an independent unmanned surface vessel. And what that means is that it's not a total robotic control, but we can send it out with human monitoring in the loop over the satellite. We have 2 satellite domes on here. So we can run this boat from anywhere in the world to anywhere in the world. It has a range of almost 2,000 miles, so it can do what a human might not want to do. It'd be very hard to go out in this boat and be living in there for a couple of weeks. But the computer doesn't matter. The people on the shore are happy being on the shore. We had a great epoxy a couple of years ago. It was about 40% better than the best epoxy. We had a EPA get involved in our business early last year. We had to sign a consent order that basically banned us from selling it. Our customers would have to get a permission slip from the EPA. They would have to wear a full Tyvek bodysuit and a full face respirator to handle this, mix this two-part epoxy. Apparently the EPA was concerned that the nanotubes would somehow escape from this viscous epoxy and get into the air and be breathed. That is not possible in this thermodynamic world, but it was an interesting theory of banning. So we signed in the early part of last year, we signed a consent decree. By the summer, they were back to us, reneging on that decree and made us sign another one. So we basically don't have that product for sale, which is good and bad. It doesn't empower our competitors. We are willing to go through the rigmarole of doing it. So in our boatyard, we can have this epoxy that we use to glue our boat together. So we have a competitive advantage over anyone else. We have a much better adhesive. I just heard earlier, late last year, that Bayer in Germany was one of the world's largest manufacturers of nanotubes. They have shut down. I heard from a guy that was a senior manager there who's looking for a job now in the US. The environmentalists shut them down. Even after they have demonstrated safety, they have convinced themselves that these tubes are safe. And the issue about the nanotubes being unsafe is they have an aspect ratio like spaghetti, so they're longer than their diameter. Well, asbestos has an aspect ratio like spaghetti. It's also longer than its diameter. Therefore, nanotubes must be like asbestos because they're shaped like spaghetti. So that's the argument for banning them. In spite of any real experimental evidence to the contrary. And there have been some press release type studies that indicate that we need to be careful with this. I am happy to say, though, that we've had, actually, NIOSH is one of the government agencies that seems to be a little less wild about their accusations. They came in and looked at us, and we scored very, very well, better than any other company, in fact, on handling of the nanotubes. And I figure, as a deep pocket rich guy, I've got to have best practices in my company. You know, I don't need the government telling me to do stuff. I'm doing it because I fear lawyers on the other side, and I want to be sure that our employees have a safe environment. Export control, I have some good news here. Last year I was grumpy about that all because we had the sports was the first market for our materials. They moved all their production to China. We could not follow because we were export controlled. Our materials got above a certain threshold. The State Department said we can't sell them outside the U.S. The State Department didn't buy anything from us, but they also wouldn't let us sell. Just a couple of months ago, that was finally relaxed. We are now able to sell to just about anybody that I want to sell to, with the exclusion of Iran and North Korea, which I don't really have any commercial interest in. So we are now heading to Asia to look at some deals, and we may actually be able to have a much more successful company getting into many more products because of that. We had a cancer therapeutic that we were working on a few years ago, nanotubes. If they are put near a cancer, it turns out they're very strong absorbers of radio waves, which was kind of unexpected. We had a professor at MD Anderson in Houston who cured cancer in 4 out of 5 rabbits using our nanotubes injected nearby, treating with radio waves, cooking the tumor. It cooks it in a way that then the body suddenly turns on, recognizes that it's a cancer, and goes after it and cleans up any remaining little vestiges, little cell clusters that it finds. But I got to thinking about how long would it take to actually get a real therapeutic to market, and I decided I can't afford to go after 10 years and $1 billion. I'm sorry to people with cancer that we can't do anything about it, but that's just the case. Even our manufacturing of boats in Seattle was an interesting experience. We had to build an oven. Our whole boat, a 54-foot boat, is put in a mold, rolled in an oven, cured overnight at temperatures about 250 degrees Fahrenheit. We built this oven. Then the inspectors came by and said, well, you have to have a sprinkler system. And we said, it's an oven. And they said, yes, and it needs a sprinkler system inside. So we had to go find high-temperature sprinkler heads and put a sprinkler system inside our oven. And then we also got into trouble because the gas lines inside, it's a gas-fired oven. Code says 24 inches apart for the supports. My guy screwed up in a major way. We had our supports 18 inches apart. Government said, no, 24 inches. So we had to move the supports from 18 inches to 24 inches apart. So, do you think I'm going to be expanding my oven In Seattle? I'll give you one guess. I'm now applying the precautionary principle. I have taken that to heart here for my business. If I can't prove it's safe to start a new company or invest in one in the U.S., it's better to do it elsewhere. So that's what is behind my move to Singapore. We are now, in the spring, we're going to be launching an anti-piracy joint venture with an anti-pirate guy based in Dubai, and we're launching that through our Singapore company with the guy in Dubai actually taking the lead in terms of the business development, because I don't want to contemplate the legal aspects of having a company that goes after pirates based in the U.S. This is a fanciful picture of what we're trying to do, build 3D structures with atomic precision. If these blue atoms would be silicon, the green atoms would be germanium, we'd build those as a 3D crystal, but we could preferentially etch away the germanium, freeing up a 3D object with atomic precision. So my goal here is to lead the commercialization of adaptable, affordable, atomically precise manufacturing. Throughout human history, we had what I call the blacksmith model, handcrafting. A skilled artisan could make almost anything out of the materials they had at hand. And we went that way for millennia, and we had a lot of human progress thanks to that. But everything was a one-off. You didn't get any advantage of building one. You might know more the skills to build the next one, but you didn't really do it in a good manufacturing way. Ford had two great breakthroughs, I think. Henry Ford realized if you had a machine that would make a lot of identical parts, you could make the parts very cheaply. And if you had an assembly line that could put them together with specialized labor, you could do assembly very cheaply. And the combination of cheap parts and cheap assembly led to a revolution in manufacturing. The Intel Texas Instruments breakthrough was the next manufacturing breakthrough. And they realized basically a photographic negative, and you shine light through it, you can expose on a substrate, you can expose a photographic pattern, and you can then etch and deposit on that and build up a 3D structure. And if you're making electronics, you now have a flexible manufacturing by just changing the mask that you're shining the light through, changing the steps of doing the manufacturing. You have a factory called a semiconductor wafer fab that can make a huge variety of parts very cheaply. And because it's an area-based thing, the area of the wafer is what's driving your cost. If you can make the parts on that area smaller and smaller and smaller, you get more parts per the same area. Your cost is kind of controlled by the area, not by how small the features are. So the smaller your features, the more money you can make, the more functionality you can put in. It's kind of a software manufacturing model in some ways. But where we're going with atomically precise manufacturing is to say, how do we get out of that two-dimensional approach into fully three-dimensional structures? We have to build the factory itself out of the same technology that it's manufacturing. So the breakdown in the semiconductor industry is happening right now because the cost of the wafer fab is becoming astronomical. It's $3 or $4 billion to build a new manufacturing facility now because they're not profiting by making smaller parts. The technologies to make the chips are not scaling at the same way that the transistors are. But if we had an atomically precise manufacturing, it's making small precise parts. Those are exactly what we need in the factory to make cheaper factories. So now we have a double declining learning curve. As we get better at making the parts, we make more precise parts more cheaply. We put those together into the factory. The factory itself gets cheaper as the parts get cheaper. Now we're on a double declining learning curve. The economics of that are stunning. You can just see what has happened with the cost of transistors, the cost of electronic functionality, where only one dimension is changing. The part, you know, the cost per transistor is going down. Cost of the factory is going up exponentially. Imagine if both of those were going down. We now have manufacturing that is basically making, trending toward infinitely complex objects at zero cost. Sort of the economics of nature and how much does it cost to make an acorn. So that's the exciting thing to me about nanotechnology is what that does to the cost of manufacturing. I used to worry about what does that mean for jobs, what does that mean for human well-being, and the more I studied free market economics, the more I realized that's not a question that really matters. It's going to make so much wealth in society, we could well see a world where only 1% of the people actually do productive, creative things. and the rest of them are able to live off that 1%, we'll figure out a way to adapt. I think those of us who like to work will continue to work. Those who don't, hopefully, will allow us who do to continue to do our thing. And there will be enough wealth to go around. Here's a cartoon of what we're trying to do. With our current approach, we take a crystal of silicon, which is these blue atoms, coat it with hydrogen, with white atoms. So far, that's conventional semiconductor fabrication. The difference is that we come down with this scanning tunneling microscope, a very sharp probe, similar to the one that I showed you in the nano probing system, except even sharper. This thing ends in a single atom if we do it right. We can pop off the individual hydrogens from where we want. We then shower down a molecule that sticks where we popped off these hydrogens, and we grow up one layer. And then we come back and repeat it. And we do that over and over again until we have built a 3D structure. This is the system in our lab, one of two systems that we use to do that. It's an ultra-high vacuum scanning tunneling microscope. This is the ultra-high vacuum system. It's about 1/10 trillionth of an atmosphere of pressure inside. Here's a not particularly sharp tip. This is about a 1 nanometer tip. I wish it was pointier, but there is about a 1 nanometer radius, and you can basically count the atoms on that thing by putting this in a transmission electron microscope. You can't really see it there, but if you get up close, you can see a little structure of lines in here. Those are the atomic lattice planes of the tungsten atoms that are in this tip. And then this is the platform where the scanning tunneling microscopes are, two cylindrical gold-coated objects here. The sample rides on these rails. The whole thing is on a spring because it can't have vibration. So some places have exotic vibration damping. Ours is pretty straightforward. It's just in a little industrial facility in Richardson, Texas. We rely on these springs to isolate this from the surrounding vibration to allow us to get atomic precision. Here's a little structure we were doing. Our sample preparation was not very good, so we have a lot of white dots on the surface. And this one, we were showing the repeatability of the lines we can make. Here's some early structures that we're starting to make, atomically precise patterns. These rows, by the way, are rows of silicon atoms. Each of these rows represents two silicon atoms that are paired together. We popped the hydrogens off of these, and you can see we're starting to build some atomically precise structures. It's a long way to go to actually build this up into 3D, but we are making slow progress. Now, the long-term goal is to build a factory, and here's a fanciful picture from a movie that was done a few years back on what a factory might look like. The molecules come in here through this sorting rotor, and I will say that these things mix atomic precision and solid modeling in a way that kind of it makes it easy to show a video, but it doesn't make it very clear where all the atoms are. So don't look at this as saying matter is continuous here and discrete here. In reality, the matter would be discrete everywhere, and this would all be individual atoms. But we have a rotor that is big enough to take one of these molecules in, reject others that are not the same molecule, run them through this little mill thing, and over in this compartment we have a concentration of the particular molecule that is trying to sort until we get a very pure version of this molecule. We then pick it up in another binding pocket. We deposit it here and have a building block that we can then stack into another structure. We eventually build big factories that are handling these little bricks, carrying them around and building useful stuff. Very fanciful. We're a long way from that today, but it's a great vision toward which we're headed. Got one more effort going on at Zyvex Labs. A few years back, we ran into this Israeli company, medical device company, and we're now joint venturing with them. This is an outgrowth of some of our silicon micromachine work that we used to do, building little 3D micromachines. We're actually partnering with them to build this nano retina, a bionic eye, if you will. It's going to be a little device about that big. It will be implanted into your eye. It's a bed of nails, electrodes, chip, and basically a image sensor like a camera would have, powered by an infrared laser in some glasses that the blind person would wear. The infrared laser shines light, which powers the device. It uses your own eye's lens to focus an image onto the imaging array, and then it stimulates the nerves. And we just made our first package of that, shipped off the first five to our partners in Israel last week. So we're moving forward with that. Pretty excited about the potential there, and I don't have to be the guy getting through FDA approval. We have a tried and true medical entrepreneur in Israel who's doing the work of getting it approved and finding partners. So I'm happy to go work on medical stuff if I have an expert who really knows what they're doing. You might have heard about the National Nanotech Initiative that was kicked off in 99. Clinton signed a bill, put about $400 million a year into it, and suddenly all the professors in the universities that were dismissing nanotech as science fiction overnight discovered that they were doing nanotech, and could they have some of this money, please? And it became a very popular thing. The whole world kicked off nanotech initiatives. We've ramped it up to well over $1 billion a year in the U.S., $3 billion a year in the rest of the world. Even social studies departments have found a way to play, talking about social responsibility and, you know, are the right people being brought into nanotechnology? We need focus groups. We need to ask humans, the populace, what do they think of nano and what should nano do for them? This kind of reminds me of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, if you saw the final episode where the marketing people are studying, you know, fire and, you know, what do we want out of fire? Are we really going to allow fire to be used? The private sector, though, is plowing forward with imprecise nano, not the atomic precision that I'm trying to do, but coatings, sunscreen. L'Oreal is one of the biggest patenters in nanotechnology. They're doing a huge amount of work to make better cosmetics through nanotech. Sunscreen is kind of interesting because they take nano-sized particles of various materials. Zinc oxide is one of the favorites. It's small enough that it's smaller than the wavelength of light. Visible light doesn't see it, it passes right over it. But it's bigger than the wavelength of ultraviolet light, so it looks like a block to ultraviolet. So it mechanically blocks the light from getting through. So instead of the white stuff that you normally used to have in the early days of sunscreen, where it's kind of an imprecise size, with the nano sunscreens, they're very carefully tuned to block only the ultraviolet and allow visible through, so it's invisible at optical wavelengths. We have nano silver, a number of companies working on nano silver antibiotics. It turns out that most bacteria can't deal with silver ions, so that's a very effective antibiotic. And you might have heard of nano pants a few years ago. It's really big nano clothes, which you'd spill wine on and it would just rinse off. These companies are making billions or maybe even tens of billions in revenue today. I think they're all point solutions. They're not really leading to a nanotech revolution, but still it's a lucrative business model. I think the atomic precision is key to really a general purpose manufacturing revolution. And as far as I know, Zyvex is the only company really working toward that end.